Welcome to the New Founding Project, where we take you behind the curtain of the commercial and cultural movement for the American people. You'll hear firsthand discussions of employees at New Founding who are working to connect, curate, and advocate for those looking to build and defend a better way of life. And now, for your host, the president and co-founder of New Founding, Matthew J. Peterson.
Hey, this is Matthew Peterson, and today we are engaged in another New Founding Project episode. This one is a long time coming, and I hope all of you already realize, you know about the existence of American Reformer, but if not, you will after today. So traipsing around the office, there's a number of people here that people don't even know about because they come in through one angle and then they don't even know what else is behind the curtain. And Venture Studio has all kinds of surprises. And one of those is Josh Abitoy, who is with me here today, and he's going to talk about American Reformer. But before we do that, I think even to explain that, to understand that, we need to know, who the heck are you? How'd you end up here?
Thanks, Matt. It's good to be here. Yeah. I'm a lawyer, a corporate lawyer. So, you know, I graduated Harvard Law School in 2015. I was practicing private equity mergers and acquisitions down in Houston, toiling in, you know, anonymity, had my head down for years.
Wait a minute, though. I can interrupt you. I mean, you're living the dream in a way, right? Yeah. I mean, isn't that the dream? Like, you, Harvard Law School, going into private equity, boom.
Making great money. And, you know, actually, my career progression, you can kind of understand as a way of actually, like, fleeing woke insanity. So, I went up to Harvard Law School a moderate, if you can believe that. I was a very reasonable person who wanted to hear all sides and was disabused of my notions of the marketplace of ideas at law school. And then, you know, I thought, well, you know, I mean, most of my friends were going to work on Wall Street and things like that, right? And I thought, well, you know, I'll go work for the oil and gas industry in Houston, you know, at some big law firms down there, like make some money, get away from the insanity. And, you know, it followed me there, you know. The major firms have generally just reoriented themselves around the demands that are foisted on them by their public company clients, you know, DEI and ESG requirements. You know, insane things. So, you know, it really came to a head during, you know, 2020 and you know, COVID, and, you know, the protests and, you know, so I'm making great money, but, you know, keeping my head down, being a good corporate citizen and just thinking the world's, you know, kind of going to pot all around me. And, you know, I remember that that summer of 2020, you know, I'm grilling some steaks on the grill. It's July 4th. You know, I watched Trump's, you know, speech, and, you know, my kids are playing in the backyard. We got some patriotic music blaring over the speaker, having a beer. And I actually got a little misty eyed. I felt like this feels a little bit like a wake for our country, because what really got me was, I wonder if my kids are going to feel the same sense of pride that I did when I was a kid about being American. Is this something that the next generation, do we feel like we have a special heritage that we can be proud of? It seems that the conditioning is now so thorough that, you know, we have to be deeply ashamed of our past, and we, you know, any pride in our founders and our ancestors is, you know, invidious, not something healthy and good. So, you know, that sort of marked a turning point for me. And, you know, at the same time that I have my head down and I know things are going crazy, you know, I'm looking at leaders of a lot of institutions, whether they be political, but particularly Christian, evangelical Christian leaders, you know, who they're out there, they have structural resiliency. They, you know, my denomination is the Southern Baptist. There's 14 million of us, 90% of us voted for Donald Trump. But our leaders were out there. You know, we had this guy, Russell Moore, you know, who led our think tank and in some ways was deemed to be our spokesperson. He was out there saying things like, you know, the bulk of Trump supporters are racist or white supremacist. And so there was this severe gulf between evangelical Protestant leadership and then, you know, the instincts of the people in the pews or the instincts of the people you know, at the front lines, who see the CRT and the woke insanity in their workplace. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't getting this cover, and it was on CRT. It was also on the COVID stuff. I mean, there was a massive sort of elite populist divide in evangelicalism over COVID, where I think the people showed themselves to have correct instincts. They knew everything was going insane. They knew that, you know, we needed to continue normal life. We needed to continue, you know, meeting as churches and not locking down, continue human society. Most of our leadership were telling us, you know, if you love your neighbor, you will wear the mask. If you love your neighbor, you will get the vaccine. You know, you will not come to church. You will stay home. You will be in the pod. And, you know,
Like they're mixing politics and religion. I don't know. Almost like a kind of Christian nationalism.
Yes, it's Christian nationalism when you
when we do it.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, so a few things. One is that speech and that day. I remember as well. I was misty-eyed myself just because Trump had finally said the words, and we had worked really hard that summer, and. It was the Publius Fellowship in San Diego, and so we're there at the young Little Lebowski Urban Achievers, the Claremont Young Leaders, and he had been quiet, you know, like Trump hadn't said much about what was going on, and just because he said those words, like Michael Anton, myself, and a few others, I mean, we're all like sitting around, and we were just, thank God, you know, he said it, and American Way of Life, which is Tom Klingenstein's phrase, and, you know, Claremont's phrase. I mean, he grabbed onto it and said it. But because he said that, I mean, it elicited this response, because I think anyone serious listening is thinking the same thoughts. Will this survive? Will my kids have this? So
it was beautiful, but it also was very sad. It felt like a window into a country that was disappearing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so this leadership problem, I think a lot of us see this. I mean, it's all over the world, right? I mean, that you see people struggling to find representation in Europe, you know, definitely, like, most people do not agree with a lot of things going on, but they struggle to find leaders and parties that represent them. Certainly the Republican Party here is the same way. It's sort of the reason for Donald Trump. But it's interesting what you're pointing out, because you would think that of all places where you wouldn't have elite capture, I mean, I guess, you know, looking at history, you would know this would happen, but you would hope that the churches would be, you know, still on the ball, that it'd be very hard for people to go to church with leaders who are this far disconnected, calling them racist for voting for Trump or whatever. How do you see that happening?
That's really explained by I like the analytical framework that's been put forward by one of our co-founders, Aaron Wren. He has this, what he calls the three worlds of evangelicalism. He wrote up a big article on it earlier this year in First Things. But you know, here he says that, you know, there's these three phases, you know, sort of most of our history, we were in a situation where being an evangelical Protestant was really a net positive for your social standing, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that period persists somewhere until, you know, perhaps through the 80s into the early 90s. And then, you know, during the 90s, and obviously there's variance geographically and all of that. But at some point in the early 90s, we shift into what he calls a neutral world. And this is a world where, you know, you can be a Christian and be in the public square. You can be open about your beliefs, but you know, it doesn't really hurt your standing, but you're sort of an ambassador. And so during this neutral world, a lot of evangelical leaders adopted a cultural engagement strategy of, you know, listening to all sides. You know, we want to be good partners at the table of public discourse, right? You know, sort of some of this is going along with, you know, the end of history and Rawlsian ideas about the public square. But, you know, we're one voice among many. We're sanguine about pluralism. Let's all have a dialogue. Our interlocutors from outside our church are operating in good faith. That's a key assumption. You know, so there's sort of key figures who champion this approach. And really, that became the dominant model in Christian institutions. And so, you know, if you led a major Christian institution, what you were doing when you spoke publicly and engaged in these rhetorical exercises was, you know, you were explaining the reasonableness of Christians to coastal elites. That's, you know, that you were doing PR for the church to high status professional managerial people on the coasts. And the thing that changed, and you know, it's entering negative world, entering this phase where if you're like a religious person, you know, who holds to any kind of historical distinctives, it's now actually a net negative for your social standing. This probably, you know, Aaron Wren, I think, pinpoints Obergefell as the turning point. You could quibble about where it exactly is, but at some point, it really didn't matter how good your PR was. People were going to want to marginalize you merely for being a Christian, you know, sort of regardless of how reasonable you sounded. You know, this was marked by, you know, Tim Keller is a very, you know, very reasonable, very soft-spoken, winsome, you know, pastor in New York City. And he was going to receive a reward at Princeton Theological Seminary, and student activists, this was been in the mid-teens, student activists raised a stink about it, and the seminary backed out and retracted the opportunity for him to go speak and receive a reward there. And this is sort of a turning point. You know, if Tim Keller, this very winsome, reasonable man, is just not even welcome at Princeton Theological Seminary, then, you know, nobody is who still is sort of holding to a historical evangelical framework. So this is all happening, you know, and this helps to explain the elite divide, because we've got the people in the pews of churches who are on the front lines at corporations, universities. They're seeing it in the public schools. They're seeing our culture go insane. And they've got a leadership class who's a little bit insulated from that. When you're in the bubble of a Christian institution, you may not, you know, unless you're intentional about it, you may not actually realize how tough things are, how sort of repressive the regime is out in the real world. And so, you know, there's
this, by the way, real quick, reminds me of a lot of older conservative leaders, just in political, you know, think tank world, you know, that they're fairly comfortable. And I don't think, you know, the whole thing's always a grift, like everyone complains, but, you know, they're people of goodwill, but they're not ever going to experience what DEI is like, right? I mean, if you were sitting at AEI back then, I mean, you have no idea what's going on with this stuff, right? At those kinds of institutions. And I think that's actually an enormous problem. And it's interesting because the people who are on the front lines in professional status are far more savvy, aware, and pissed off. You know, they're angry than these clowns who are, you know, still wringing their hands about things. But I think it's, you know, the point is not just in the churches, it's everywhere.
Our strongest allies are conservative Christians who have their heads down working in corporations, educated, smart people. Who see the insanity on the front lines. That's our core audience. That's the person that our messaging, I think, resonates the most with in many ways.
We'll talk more about that messaging. I mean, there is a transitional period you're describing where all of a sudden, you know, it doesn't matter. You're not welcome in the public square. You need to be canceled. You need to be persecuted because of your beliefs. Okay, so... So where do we go from here? I mean, what does that mean for how things should have changed? I mean, what should have these leaders done?
Right. Well, it needs to happen, and I think it will happen naturally. But you know, we want to, you know, ease that transition and help. But what needs to happen is, you know, our leaders need to have more of an internal orientation where, you know, rather than taking validity from or taking legitimacy from mainstream social acceptance, we need leaders who are primarily drawing their legitimacy from the acclaim of the people that they're leading, right? So we need to lean into having owned space and lean into the strength and resilience that comes from that. You know, we need anti-fragility in our leaders. And that's a generational shift. It's happening. There are key figures who are moving and I think getting much better. But we want to facilitate that and hasten it. So in other words, it's consolidation, consolidation of power and reorientation of leaders to, you know, being good shepherds for their flocks in an increasingly hostile world, not selling their flocks out. So that's happening, but we want to hasten that in our pages. You know, and the final thing, you know, I think is that we're in a very politically confusing time, and many of our Christian leaders are sort of slow to recognize this. They're relatively sort of normal, patriotic Americans in their orientation. They're big fans of democracy and our constitutional order. And I think that they're a little bit slow to recognize some of the fraying edges on our constitutional structure. So a lot of what we're trying to do is, I think, just explain and sort of open up the universe of possibilities for political arrangements. We're entering a time where, you know, achieving substantively just goals is getting more important relative to the process by which we do it. And I think people are starting to recognize that, but we want to push that because in the coming years, you know, it's going to matter more, you know, if you can get a state governor to be bold and protect, you know, the miners of his or her state from genital mutilation, right? That, something like that is going to be more important than, you know, some of the procedural niceties that folks tend to focus on. And so I think we need to get Christian leaders and influencers ready to understand that and be willing to support it at local levels and take sort of more aggressive action, you know, whether that be sort of reinvigorated federalism or more rigorous understandings of departmentalism, right? This idea that the various branches of the federal government and even the federal government relative to states, that there's a contest for power, but each one owes an independent duty of constitutional fidelity. And just understanding that that's a struggle, a political struggle that we need to sort of lean into.
Very different from the national focus of the last really post-World War II era, right? And the rise of the religious right existing in a way to counteract Roe v. Wade. And now all of a sudden we enter state and local time. I love it. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about what the heck American Reformer actually does, though. Okay, so wait a minute. Before we get to what American Reformer actually does, so you did describe kind of in a general way your trajectory. And how did you end up doing American Reformer, though? I mean, you rejected Mammon and decided you wanted to do something different. You saw these leaders, kind of failing to meet the moment. And then you ended up with American Reformer.
Yeah. It's something I've obviously had an amateur interest in for a long time. You know, I actually, while I was at Harvard Law School, I had a reading group that Adrian Vermeule was in when he was converting to Catholicism and becoming an integralist. And I guess I've always been into this post-liberal thought. You know, I've read Claremont over the years and all of that. So I had a strong intellectual affinity for it. And, you know, During that time where I was a professional laboring in anonymity, I was, you know, reading Claremont, listening to podcasts, you know, doing the sued thing on Twitter. And, you know, just at some point fell into a conversation with you and Nate and ultimately just led to a job. I saw American Reformers launch. I was really excited about, the angle that it was pitching and this prospect of, you know, sort of rigorous Protestant reactions to, the breakdown of classical liberalism. And, you know, as a Protestant myself, somebody who enjoys a lot of the integralists, I did think, you know, we need Protestants are sort of the evangelical Protestants are the, you know, dominant coalition partner on the right. And we're years behind in this conversation, and you know, and what American Reformer was doing is really exciting. It presented an opportunity to really advance that conversation in my church and the people that I care about, and I think a group that's very important electorally. So yeah, you know, I came over last fall, right, and you know took on American Reformer, and then I'm also at New Founding, you know, serving as a managing director, sort of doing doing general legal stuff, and you know, heading up a lot of deals and strategic work for the company. But
and we should say we're going to later today be talking to some entrepreneurs and that okay. we're gonna be connecting to investors. So you know, the not so secret project yes. of connecting non-woke capital to, you know, to efforts that are truly disruptive. Yep. You know, Josh says that as well. This, before we get into to what it does, this bit you just kind of laid out, I mean, I find it interesting but frustrating, the intellectual discussions at this point about, you know, classical liberalism is dead. What do we do now? Post-liberal. Yes, it's all true. There's problems with classical liberalism, especially as conceived in the American mind post-World War II. But the real interesting part is the religious part, mm-hmm. right? Because all of a sudden, what is the relationship between church and state? What should that look like? We're not in a situation where there's a number of different kinds of Protestant anymore. And that changes the game. The founders didn't think you could have a nation, right, without Christianity. And, you know, my own trajectory is evangelical-ish, you know, Protestant growing up. RC conversion, you know, went to Rome or whatever they say.
Swam but, the Tiber.
Yeah, right. That's right. And I hate that phrase, though. I do like Rome to visit. But this integralism, I mean, for those who are unaware, I mean, it's essentially saying we need to go back to get rid of the separation of church and state. The church has its role. The state has its role. But they should, like, we should connect the church bone to the state bone, you know, and then everything will be well. And obviously there's a lot to debate because it's all in the details. But it's at least an interesting group of Catholics who are saying that. And there's all varieties of responses against them. The biggest thing that I noticed throughout this whole period was, where the heck are the Protestants? Where is everybody, you know? And I will say, you know, what we're talking about is important because the success, I think, that American Reformer has already had, I don't even know if I've mentioned this before, is very real, right? So the National Conservatism Conference, right, was having a problem. You know this, Hazzoni was having a problem finding Protestants to go to it, you know, kind of this new right conference I've talked about before on the podcast. And this, you know, the opposite has now occurred where he can't find the Catholics. And so I think I've witnessed this reversal in my life where, besides the integralists who, you know, have their ups and downs, but are interesting, there's sort of a turning away among a lot of elite or conservative Catholics, where I'm looking at that world, my world, going, I don't even expect anything from you guys. Like, you guys don't know what to do, and I don't know how to move you. I'm just gonna keep doing what I'm doing. In the meantime, you know, there is this resurgence, this sign of life, where American Reformer has, you know, has lit a fire under people to realize on the Protestant side how bad things are, and also that. You know, they have to rethink what they do as America goes forward.
Yeah.
I want to know more about, I'm just going to push off what you do at American Reformer. I want to know more, but this will lead to it. I want to know more about how you do that. I guess it's the same question. I mean, how has this worked so far? Did people just, you know, have you converted people? Was it just people quietly out there in the woodwork who just said, thank God you're doing this, and came together? I mean,
Yeah. I think the ask that we make of Protestant Christians is a little bit less ambitious than the ask that integralists make of their following,
right.
Which is that we can present a, you know, paleo-liberal framework, whatever you want to call it, that can still sit very naturally with the American founding, mm-hmm. right? Protestantism is comfortable with federalism. We're comfortable with the idea that there would be various states, and those various states would have sort of particular religious establishments. but also some of what we say is much more modest. We're not even necessarily, you know, pushing for like an established church. But we're, pardon me, we're comfortable with, you know, well, we want to, and there's a lot of buy-in to rolling back, you know, Warren Court innovations, right? Like we forget, you know, establishment, I mean, establishment properly is like when the government says you cannot preach unless we give you a license, right? But following the Warren Court, everybody was sort of psyoped to think that establishment meant if you have a prayer in a school, you know, or, you know, and so there's so much wood to chop, and there's a lot of willingness and buy-in to just get, let's, you know, just throw away, you know, establishment, jurisprudence, and politics since the 50s, you know, and, you know, the Thomas Jefferson's wall of separation, you know, that's a minority viewpoint among the founders. It's one small stream. It's not the, you know, it's not the seed of the, you know, that ultimately flowered into, you know, Rawlsian pluralism in the late 20th century. So there's tremendous buy-in for that project at a high level. You know, within that, there's a lot of variants. There's people that are much more rigorous, and they do want something that's much more directly analogous to sort of a Protestant integralism. But, you know, there's a much broader agenda there, which is basically to say, hey, we're a generally Christian nation, always have been. Our morality will naturally be reflected in the laws, and maybe, you know, and that's, there's nothing wrong with that. That's not at odds with our founding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love a lot of this because it's a lot of it's where I am practically. So of course I like it. But the idea, I mean, the biggest problem with a lot of the post-liberal stuff is just ignorance in a way that, no, this was all, a lot of the separation of church and state is a modern conception that came out of nowhere in the last, you know, 70 years that was foisted up by a bunch of secularists or Christian haters, basically, on the country. And was not even a thinkable, wasn't even a deal for a long time. No one would have thought you could have prayer in schools. I mean, they might have started wrangling over which prayer, you know. But the idea, like the idea that we have of what liberalism is, has shifted dramatically. And at the very least, we need to get rid of it. Well, we'll get to the big question later. So break down though, what does American Reformer currently do?
Sure. Yeah. So we've got a journal. The journal is you know, some people might call it like a Protestant First Things. It's fairly academic in tenor. We are pitching to influential, you know, evangelical Christians. You know, we demand a lot of our readers. Our stuff is thick. I think it's really well argued. Really proud of it. Really demonstrated an ability to impact the conversation over the last year. And I do think, you know, to take a small victory lap, there's certainly other partners involved in this, but I do think that the strength at NatCon this past year by the Protestants was, you know, largely sort of our voice was attributable to a lot of that. I think we're the natural place where this conversation is happening on the internet, you know, that people are reading. You know, and then we've got a reform work, which is a bit different. You could think of this as the action side of our house. But in this capacity, we're consulting with people who lead Christian institutions, who want help, who are working through institutional struggles, or they want to reform, they want to reinvigorate the places that they have influence at. So, you know, we've been involved at Grove City. People may have heard about that. We wrote a long sort of expose in American Reformer about claims of CRT and mission drift at Grove City College. Maybe your listeners don't know, but Grove City College is sort of this, sort of like Hillsdale. It's a sort of famous conservative Christian college that, you know, they sued the federal government and left federal funding on the table in the 80s. Actually, Angelo Codevilla used to teach at Grove City. I don't know if you knew that, but he had a stint there in the 70s. But, nice. You know, there's famous sort of hotbed of Austrian economics and, you know, and, you know, recently they just, you know, trouble signs, you know, red flags popping up there. And they're dealing with a big grassroots uprising right now. Parents and alumni who are sort of frustrated with the direction. And, you know, I mean, there's currently a petition out there.
The direction being bowing down a little bit to the wokeness, et cetera.
Yeah. And I would say sort of soft peddling the conservative heritage. There's sort of some distancing, some ambivalence about that past. And, you know, so there's a petition out there on the internet right now that, you know, is calling for a leadership change. And some very big names have signed it. I mean, your people can go check it out at savegrovecity.com. But very meaningful people have publicly signed it. Like,
I mean, saving an institution that's been around for decades that could potentially, you know, grow into another Hillsdale in, you know, in like power, that has the foundation. And what it sounds like, I mean, it's really, that's what the battle is about, right? It's like saving this institution and putting it on a path to success.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it could be like Hillsdale. It could be more. I mean, it's always been more distinct. The distinguishing factor historically has been the, Grove City leans more into its Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's sort of a, you know, two horns on the same goat. You've got Christianity and then you've got the political conservatism, and those are sort of the two core ingredients. And yeah, I mean, to see that institution sort of flourish, as another center of power, another talent pipeline, to feed people into the movement, would be beautiful to see. So yeah, that's, we've been advising that grassroots coalition for, you know, a year now, you know, helping with some media spotlights on their arguments in the situation. I've written about it under my own name, and, you know, and then, you know, a number of other big names have kind of weighed into the controversy. You know, so that's maybe our biggest one, but we do a lot of consultations all the time. I've talked to boards, either full boards or just, you know, individual trustees of other institutions that want to manage their institutions prudently right now. Talk to, you know, groups of pastors and leaders of different evangelical denominations, helping them with, you know, resources, perhaps media spotlight, anything that we can do to assist their efforts in sort of making their institutions fit for the choppy waters that we're in right now. Yeah. That's what we're interested in. So, and you know, there's a lot of, we're interested in building coalitions too, you know, so if you have listeners who want to get involved, if they have some influence, whether it be in a church, in a denomination, in a Christian college, we're interested in hearing from people like that and finding ways to partner.
Yeah, I mean, this is demonstrated help that you give to help people out, to save institutions, but also just to further a more robust agenda on the part of our leaders. So you also do events? Is
that? Yeah. So we're actually going to be the coming year. We're really ramping up a lot of our offerings. So we've done some events this past year, but this coming year we're going to have some smaller events in different major metro areas. So more to come on that. But certainly we're going to have something in Dallas, New York City as well, and then working on a couple other locations. But these are going to be sort of somewhat intimate gatherings, you know, but if folks are in these major cities, just keep an eye out, because we're going to have some cool opportunities for engagement coming up on that front. We're also planning a larger conference for the fall of this year. Dates are TBD, but we would like to convene a gathering of evangelical Protestants to talk about the future of the religious right next fall. And we also partner with the Edmund Burke Foundation on some things. So we're hoping to have some stuff coming down the pike very soon this coming year, in partnership with the NatCon folks. Mm-hmm. So we've got that cooking. We've got a fellowship that we kicked off. We did a pilot last summer, and we'll be running that fellowship again this year. This is for sort of rising, you know, Christian academics or influencers, sort of construed broadly. So, and then we're finally really excited. We'll be launching podcasts in the coming weeks. So we'll have two different podcasts, an editor's podcast, and then William Wolf will be doing an author's podcast where he interviews various of our writers to talk through their articles. So yeah, exciting stuff coming down the pike, and we're ramping up our content production as well, moving to daily content, and some of which will be a little bit more, you know, accessible and sort of news cycle relevant relative to our longer form stuff. So want to broaden our reach, incrementally in that way, and become a hub for politically civic minded Christians.
Yeah, it really is an idea that just needed to be done so badly. And I used to complain about this all the time. And it's hilarious to me that without me having to do anything as a Catholic, it happened. So we're talking about AmericanReformer.org. And again, it's not just a publication. And if you go to AmericanReformer.org, you can read about the reform initiative that he's talking about and that Josh is leading and helping with. So the way they put it there is seeks to address this issue by partnering with leaders and other key stakeholders within Christian institutions who are seeking to reform and revitalize their institutions for the challenges of today. If you're out there listening or you know someone who would need this, you want them to do this. I don't care whether you're Protestant or not, or even religious. There's no way that America moves in the right direction. If you can't get the Southern Baptists on your side, you're not going to win, right? This is the coalition that's absolutely necessary. They're doing great work. So we are going to come back and talk about the future. Let's go right back to the big picture, putting the pieces back together, the religious, right? I mean, yes. At the end of the day, I put it this way. I don't hold me to it. I'm a changing of mind on these things as I go. But if I was Constantine right now, right, if I was Charlemagne, if I was, Christian Caesar, put it that way, my take would actually be the church should be one. It's broken. It's not. My nation is Nicene Creed, affirming. But I'm going to, much like the emperors used to, I'm going to convene a council and you guys should figure this out. You should talk amongst yourselves. Not ridiculous ecumenism, but just ecumenical BS, but just kind of saying we are Christian. I am Catholic, but I'm not going to force that upon you all. I'm going to say you all need to, all Christians need to get together. That's above my pay grade as a political leader. And I actually think that, in other words, it's like a America 2.0 in my mind would probably be like that. You can disagree. You can not agree. But I do think that practically the coalition looks the same regardless, right? How do you see that going forward? I mean, what is the, ideally, right, what does the religious right look like and what does it focus on and what does it do in the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think just as an electoral reality, to win, we need to have a coalition that includes evangelicals. It even needs to include people from Protestant mainlines who still share a lot of our fundamental political values, and it needs to include Catholics conservative Jewish folks as well. That's a fundamental political reality. And the things that we need to focus on, I mean, it sounds simple, but I mean, let's focus on like really fundamental issues, these low hanging fruit issues like, what is a man or what is a woman, or gender insanity, abortion, right to life issues. Those are animating and unite that whole coalition. And look, for the foreseeable future, those are the political issues that we can realistically, even address. It can be fun to think about the limits and think about hypothetical societies and what would the exact relationship between church and state be in such a society, but that's so far away. We can think about that, but in the interim, we need to all be standing in the same shield wall. So
yeah, and say more about that. I mean, so in order to foster, the shield wall, what you guys are doing is to no small extent stirring up controversy, and talking about Christian nationalism and so forth. And actually, I think we're going to save that one for another day, because we can and should spend the whole time talking about it. Yes. For everyone who wants to nerd out on it out there in the audience. But I want to stick with the practical. Do you, in the past, it really was like, we're going to go in the public square and we're going to argue, and the words and the right rhetoric is going to persuade people, and we're going to show them that we're good members of society, you know, that we belong here too, even though that was anyone, it should be reversed, right? Does anyone else belong who isn't, you know, Christian? Because even the guys who weren't that Christian at the time of the founding thought it was absolutely necessary to have a republic. And if you didn't have that, you didn't have a republican form of government, it would be destroyed. So none of the founders would think that a society in which they jettisons Christianity could have our form of government. Like, they'd be like, it's done. So that's just what they said. But in the past it was, we're going to come and we're going to debate people and we're going to persuade them. And now I feel like if you look at your own life and my life, I mean, we're like moving around the cabin. I mean, we're actually like, no, I'm going to move from, you know, this place to this place, or this job to this job, because we need to band together. And it seems like there's a practical agenda there. Do you see this being acknowledged or at least acted on in, you know, these kind of communities? Is that become a thing yet where people can talk about publicly?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there's an increasing recognition that, you know, the deliberative republic, I mean, that's great for religious, virtuous people. And people want that. It's awesome. It's great to be able to have good faith deliberation with people that you share fundamental assumptions with and you trust. I think generally amongst our audience, there's interest in finding that, and there's also more recognition and acceptance of, this doesn't mean we're going to hunker down into a quirky, very specific Protestant niche, but we're going to be, you know, there will be both, you know, ecumenicism among Protestants, so sort of across, you know, we're seeing strong alliances between Baptists and Presbyterians, for example, right? But then also, you know, reaching over to Roman Catholics as well. You're seeing that for, you know, for political action, there's significant unity, and really in a lot of ways, the unifier of, you know, people knowing what time it is, what they need to do, consolidate power, own space. There's an acceptance that that's a common project with, Christians construed broadly. Yeah. And there's a lot of basis for united action on that front. And, you know, like, so let's lean into restoring and consolidating so that we can have deliberation at local and state levels. And then at the federal level, I think there's more agnosticism about the tactics. Like, we realize that, the social conditions that allowed the Constitution to work the way it's supposed to work are very much imperiled right now. And so there's dysfunction. That's the very natural and foreseeable result of those social conditions being imperiled. And So let's just operate, you know, prudently and do what we can to achieve substantive good at that level.
Which sadly is not going to come from, erudite debate, most likely at the national level. But nonetheless, that debate is happening, and that in an intelligent way is enormously important for these communities. And, I have seen this. You see this now where what you said, when people see how bad things are, then all of a sudden it becomes obvious that they have to band together in some way. And there, I mean, the most obvious thing would be if you're in an area where you don't have an option as far as schools go, and they're going to trans your kids, that's what they're all about. They're groomers, they're there. You want to be in a community where everyone there, I really don't care about, you know, everything else. We can debate that over beer, but I just want to know you're not going to groom my kids. And we're all on the same page about that, what a man and a woman is and what sexual abuse is, not to mention mutilation, et cetera. And that that also gives me some hope, because I think that's so obvious, right? That needs to happen. That all of a sudden, people just change their their thinking on these things and realize like, okay, well, I need to find this community. I love what you said about the weird thing too, because that's always the Benedict option problem, right? To abuse Dreher's concept like everyone else does, which is just bunker, you know, just bunker down somewhere and wait it out. And, you know, things get weird if a community isn't big enough, which is always the way it is. It's like my Latin Mass friends. You know, I was married in a fraternity, St. Peter Latin Mass, but you know, the knock on that is this is always a little weird, and I don't think that's always fair. But the idea that we're describing is, you know, is not that. It's really much broader. It's people. It's what you see happening in Texas and Florida, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think there's like, I mean, the way I look at it, you know, there's a sort of a simple test. Like, am I living around neighbors that I trust my kids going to their house?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, everybody wants to be in a society mm-hmm. where you can actually have that. And that's an interesting test, or, you know, to schools, to your point, right? Am I living in a community that's likely to create a school that I actually would entrust my kids to? Mm-hmm. Those are very telling tests. And that's what we're seeing. You know, I mean, you probably know this, but there's this classical Christian school movement that's sort of exploding right now. And it's, you know, it's ecumenical in the sense that we're talking about. It cuts across, you know, various Protestant denominations and Catholics, but, you know, they are united on some of these key tactical questions in a way that makes them effective at sort of coordinated action. So,
yes, that's the kind of coalition I see developing, and it's a small renaissance, really. I mean, it's a small, but it's a real renaissance of education at the K-12 level with these classical schools. But the intellectual, cultural, political renaissance that we need is being brought about by American reformers. So I would say if you're interested in any of these topics, it should be on your radar. And, you know, if this is more of the bullseye for you, you should go to that website and sign up, donate. You know, if you know people who need help with their institutions, have them get on here. AmericanReformer.org. One of the things that Josh does around here. But we have to go. We have to go on to the rest of our work today, which is entrepreneurs and founders and investment. Very good stuff. Very exciting stuff that I hope we can share more about as we go as well. So I would say this: next time we talk, we need to just do a episode on Christian nationalism and all that stuff, and get into it. We'll really nerd out on it. But this was our intro. So I hope everyone enjoyed it. And thank you, Josh, for being here.
Thank you, Matt. This was great.
All right. You all have a good rest of your day. Remember to take care of yourself these days. People can stare into the darkness too long. We need you to stay limber. We need to stay alive and awake. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the New Founding Project. Please remember to subscribe and review this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To join our cause, go to newfounding.com to become a member. Also, go to joinaline.us to sign up for the Align newsletter, where you can find pro-American alternatives to corporate woke companies. To sign up for the Return magazine, go to return.life and learn how to live well in the digital age. And to sign up for American Reformer, go to AmericanReformer.org. Again, we thank you for listening and hope you'll tune in next time for another installment of the New Founding Project.